We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for this program, Harriet Williamson. At the controls right now, Kyle Mabry. Mike Pritchard was on for the first hour, and I also want to mention that he was the guy that spent all the time to pull the audio clips from Duck Soup that we ran the first part of the show to kind of punch things up as we were talking with Roy Blunt. And in just a moment here, we'll be talking with Dan McCollum about the history of Champaign County, something that he's very interested in and has done a lot of writing about. In fact, he has a relatively new book out here. It's titled Remembering Champaign County. It's published by the History Press. And you can learn a lot of things, I'm sure, about our area here, Champaign and Urbana and the small surrounding towns and the history of the county by taking a look at the book. And we'll talk about some of these things with Dan here in the first part of the show. Also here in the studio with me is our general manager, Mark Leonard. It is our fall fundraising effort here. We're raising the money that will help pay for the programming that you will hear all throughout the year, making it possible for us to do what we do on Focus and making it possible for you to hear market updates and Fresh Air and All Things Considered and Morning Edition and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and Car Talk. And I think I'll stop there. But you get the picture. What you're doing with your contribution is making it possible for us to keep the station on the air and keep the programs that you value there so that when you go over to the radio and you turn it on, we're there. That's possible because folks like you support the station with your dollars. That's what we're talking about here is a financial contribution, money. That's what we want is some money. And you can help us out right now by calling or by going online. And Mark is here to help make the pitch.
Well, there's only so many ways you can say it. You've already made the decision to listen to the station. We're just here to say it's unlike many of the other services that you have in your life. You may pay for phone service or cellular service, or you're paying in advance. A bill comes every month, and it's transactional. Same thing with cable television. Same thing perhaps with satellite radio or magazine subscriptions. Public radio really stands as a different model because it is a voluntary contribution. But it does not mean that the service is free. And in this particular drive, we need to raise $175,000. We'd like to do it as quickly as possible. We have In previous drives, we have tried to shrink the drives down in terms of the amount of time that we spend on air. And with your help, we will continue to be able to do that. But what that means is that you cannot wait till the last minute of the drive to make your contribution. You need to do it when you're listening and when you have access to a phone or an access to a computer. You need to call 244-9455 or log on at willpledge.org and select a level to participate at. At the $60 level or above, we've got a great thank you gift. It is the new Illinois Public Media stainless steel mug, and it is very attractive. It has the WILL logo on it as well as Illinois. So if you're an alumnus, it's kind of a double logo that you get. You get the Illinois iMark as well as the WILL Radio TV Online logo. It's a token. It's symbolic. But it's a way of saying, yeah, I'm paid up in full and showing it to your friends. So why not make that call right now so we can get back to the program as we do 5 days a week throughout the year? We were just talking about the volume of guests and the complexity of making sure that every day we've got two full topics, two full guests on the phone or in the studios and be able to do it reliably and interestingly. And that is invisible work to you, the listener. But I can assure you it is far from invisible for the staff here, David and Harriet Williamson, who make it happen so gracefully every week of the year. Let them know that you value the work that they put in by calling in your membership contribution.
Well, we're happy to have this morning as our guest here on the telephone, Dan McCollum. He has been on this program before, more than once, certainly. People will know him because he's been involved in politics in Champaign-Urbana for a long time. He served three terms as the mayor of Champaign. He's also been a teacher, writer, been an environmental activist, and he's also a local historian. and has authored several books, and one that's just out here now, it's new, is titled Remembering Champaign County, and it's published by the History Press. The History Press is based in Charleston, South Carolina, and it's a paperback book, and if you'd like to learn some things about Champaign-Urbana and Champaign County, this would be a great book to look for. So you can seek it out at the bookstore. And as we talk here this morning with Dan, if you have questions or maybe you have something to contribute, you can do that too. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. Hi, Dan. How you doing?
Glad to be on the program.
We appreciate it. You've lived all your life in Champaign County, right?
I think that's a safe assumption.
And has local history always been something that has interested you?
No, actually, it hasn't. But I became interested in place names.
Mm-hmm.
And as I began to sort of try to ferret out the origins of all the place names in Champaign County, of course, I encountered an increasing amount of historical facts. And I seem to have a pretty good mind for minutiae, so I guess I backed into being a local historian, at least on an amateur basis.
Yeah. Well, that's something I think is noteworthy. I don't know if people understand that so many of the place names around us, names of towns, are named after people like Sidoras and Rantoul and St. Joe, and I'm sure that there are others. Those were named for individuals who were important in the early history of the county.
Well, actually, for a very complete delineation of that, the essays on the historical geography of Champaign County, which I did some years ago and is still available, is a pretty good source for that.
Tell us about maybe we just pick one, and since you begin the book with it here, the people who are, I guess, acknowledged to be really the first white European settlers to come here in Champaign County were the Sidoras family, was Henry Sidoras and his family. Who was Henry Sidoras?
Well, Henry Sidoras, I think, was originally from Pennsylvania, traveled widely, but finally in the very early 1820s, traveled down the Ohio River and somehow wound up in Champaign County. Henry has always been credited with the first permanent settler of Champaign County. There were Euro-Americans who reached here before, but they moved through, sometimes made some improvements, but moved on. But Henry stayed, but I guess it's a male-oriented kind of approach to history that has been our tradition. But Henry came with his wife and several children, so I guess you'd have to say Henry had company, being the first permanent settler of Champaign County.
What was here when he got here?
Well, there wasn't much. As a matter of fact, I guess what you would have to say is there were no settled places. There were, this was the beginning of the Grand Prairie. The woodlands to the east sort of started at Vermilion County, which is our neighboring county to the east, and from around the borderline of Champaign County, maybe a little into Vermilion County, on to the west was the Great Savannas, which went all the way to the Great Plains.
And here it's something that, because people have been involved in prairie recreation, restoration, there are places that you can perhaps go and get something of an idea of what it would be like. But I don't know that there's any place that you could go to truly know what it was like when these folks got here and what the landscape was like.
Well, there are places where they have recreated the prairie in terms of the kinds of plants that were there. But I don't think it would be possible with all the drainage improvements we've made to make this place, or even a small portion of it, look like it was when the first Euro-Americans got here, because it was very poorly drained. The glaciers had left this undulating, relatively flat but undulating, landscape, which was very poorly drained. And So you had at least two very different kinds of prairie environments, labeled variously as the wet prairies and the dry prairies. Mm-hmm. It was not an easy place to travel. Most people think that the mountainous areas of the east along the Appalachian chain and the Rockies were very difficult places, and in fact they were, but if you had to challenge the prairies, it would have been an interesting challenge because there was an awful lot of very difficult areas to traverse because they were wet. And of course the mosquitoes carrying malaria, which was called ague or miasma, were present, and black flies, which were very unpleasant. And then there was the tall prairie grass that sometimes was the height of a man on a horse.
Mm-hmm.
So you just sometimes had a great deal of difficulty even navigating the prairies. People got lost.
That's an amazing sort of an idea, something to think about, that you could even riding on a horse. But certainly if you were on foot, the grass was tall enough so that you could actually get lost.
Well, there are some big blue-stem plantings on the University South Farms. And so if you don't believe the grass gets 8 or 9 feet tall, you can certainly see it on the University South Farms in at least one location.
Yeah, and now today, as we're here in Champaign-Urbana, Champaign County, we look around us and we see all these farm fields. We see corn and soybeans, but at this time, just even the idea that you would start into farming, this would, given the technology of the time and the conditions there of the prairie plants and how they hold on to the soil and drainage issues, just the idea of deciding that you were going to set yourself up with a farm would have been a real serious challenge.
Well, apparently the early pioneers came here, settled along the river valleys, the Salt Fork, the Middle Fork, and the Sangamon, and on the theory that it was easier to cut the trees down or girdle them and kill them and plow around the stumps than it was to try to break the prairie. It was said, and I've read this more than one place, where it costs more to break the prairie in terms of getting the oxen and the crude wooden moldboard plow cost more through that primitive method of breaking the prairie than it did to buy it.
Are there things that remain things that people built, things that people made that were not part of the built, what we would say would be the built environment, that still survive from the earliest times?
I think the oldest documentable building in Champaign County is the Cattle Bank, which dates from 1857. There is the B.F. Harris Cabin, which is on the Sangamon or near the Sangamon on the original holdings of B.F. Harris, which I think is still there, which almost certainly predates the Cattle Bank.
Mm-hmm.
But that's about it.
So that's the Cattle Bank, that's at the corner of First and University.
That's correct.
Right. And Benjamin Franklin Harris, this was one of our early magnates, I guess. We do have one other sort of important building that's related to him, and that still stands in Champaign, that's been there for a long time. That's the First National Bank of Champaign.
Well, it was built after B.F. died, but it certainly was the culmination of probably one of the most successful business careers that ever occurred in Champaign County. B.F. Harris was a thoroughly amazing guy, and he did it. Well, he did take risks. But he was calculated risks. And a lot of people who have probably made it and it's been just assessed to pure luck was not the case with B.F. Harris. And that's why I did a brief biography of him in this book, because I think he was one of the most thoroughly amazing people I ever read about.
Mm. Where the place names for Champaign and Urbana, Champaign County and Urbana, come from?
Well, a very simple explanation. It is a very simple explanation. The person who was responsible for creating Champaign County, John Vance, who came to operate the salt works over in Vermilion County, when they played out, he had to get another profession and became a state senator. And when the folks who lived in the Big Grove area, which is now mostly part of Urbana, wanted a separate county, he agreed to do so, and he drew the boundaries and saw the legislation through the General Assembly. He hailed from Champaign County, Ohio, of which the county seat was Urbana, and all he asked was that these names be transferred to the new county.
And so how is it that Urbana is the county seat? Was that just the same sort of thing? It was from where he came from, that was the county seat, so we made it the county seat here.
The legislation stipulated not the location, but the county seat would be called Urbana. Mm-hmm. So it was the name was determined in the actual legislation.
So the name, in a sense, the name existed before the place.
Yes, there are Urbanas all the way from Virginia. They sort of travel across the country too.
How at the time how did people get around? Because there was not the system of roads we have, and certainly at that time the railroad didn't exist yet.
People pretty much kept to the high ground, and the original way west across Champaign County was called the Fort Clark Road, which ran from the Illinois-Indiana line sort of almost a diagonal off to Fort Clark, which is where Peoria is today. And it followed a moraine line, the high ground, which was probably frequented originally by migrating animals and later by Native Americans. And, of course, the pioneers, this was the easiest way to get across the country, staying on the high ground, avoiding the swamps and the low and unpromising areas. So that was the first wave. Subsequently, as the county began to fill up, people began to create other roads as a sort of on an ad hoc basis and would apply for a road to be designated by the state legislature. And I've outlined these early roads in the geography that I did, but it was largely replaced by the rectangular, or should I say almost squares, of the Jeffersonian surveys, because what the early land folks had to do was to take this government land and make it real estate, and the way to do that was to survey it. This occurred in the early 1820s, and purchasers of property began to develop their farms, they didn't like these ad hoc roads running diagonally across their properties. Mm. And so by the 1860s, these roads had been forced to the actual section lines where they run today.
Mm-hmm. We have a call here. Somebody over in Mahomet. Let's talk with them on line one. Hello.
Wondering how Mahomet got its name, and does that have anything at all to do with Mohammedan?
It's really not known for sure, but when the original name of the settlement was Middletown, because it was halfway between Danville and Bloomington. It turns out when they applied for a post office that there was already a Middleton in Logan County. And one of the rules of the postal department, which is obvious, is that you can't have two cities or settlements or post offices of the same name in the same state. So I think when the application was made, that somebody perhaps with a sense of humor or who knows what motivation in the post office says, yes, you can have a post office, and we'll just call it Mohammed. And I believe that it would relate to the to the Prophet of Islam?
Well, I was going to say there are probably very few Muslims here, but I couldn't figure out where that even came from. But thank you.
All right, well, thank you.
When the railroad came through, they, of course, they continued to call it Middletown, even though the post office name was Muhammad. But when the railroad came through, the railroad had to make a choice, because obviously mail came through on the rails, had to make a choice between whether they were going to call it Middletown or Muhammad, and they went with the railroad and the postal name.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Dan McCollum. He is known for many things around Champaign-Urbana and Champaign County, but one of the things for which he's known is being a local historian, and he's the author of the book Remembering Champaign County, and a lot of the sort of stories and information here and is here in the book, and it is published by the History Press. If you're interested in finding out more about them, you can go to their website, which is historypress.net. The History Press is based in Charleston, South Carolina. And so we thought it'd be interesting to spend a little time with Dan talking about local history, and we'll continue with that in just a moment. We do want to also take just a moment or two to encourage you to support the station. This is our fall fundraising effort. We're raising the money that will pay for next year's programming. This is something that we do a couple of times during the year. We have folks who are very loyal supporters, and we want to say thanks to them, but we can't rely on the same folks to continue to support the station as time goes along, because costs do go up. And so we found, well, one of the best ways that we have to bring new folks into our organization of supporters is simply to go on the air and ask for them. So that's what we're doing here. It was something we do in the fall and the spring. We try to keep it down to the smallest number of days as possible. So this is one of those times. And you can help us out. We'll be here today, tomorrow, over the weekend, Monday. That's it. We want to make it as short as possible. But you can help us meet our goals by calling 217-244-9455, making a pledge. Or you can go online to willpledge.org. Mark Leonard is our general manager. He's here in studio with me.
And enjoying this this interview along with everyone else, learning a lot about not just Champaign, but what the terrain was like back then as a transplant to this region. That imagery is really pretty vivid in terms of what was developed from such hostile land. History is fantastic, and we get a chance to delve into history and to science and into writing and all sorts of things on Focus every single day. It enriches your brain. I'm sure if you listen on a regular basis, you're a much better conversationalist as a result of it. I know I find myself talking about topics that I've heard on Focus all the time. Right now, though, we are asking you to pay your fair share of this service. We are a member-supported organization. Over 40% of our operating revenue comes directly from our members, and we have a goal of $175,000 that we need to raise during this very short membership campaign. And I've got some good news, which is that we stand just shy of $50,000 raised so far in this drive. We stand at $49,495. So we could, in the next half hour, push ourselves over $50,000 raised so far with your help, your contribution at 244-9455. The one of the great beauties about member-supported public radio is that it keeps the station accountable to you, the listener. We pay extreme attention to the comments that we receive, both on the air, in writing, in email. We circulate them among our staff so that we can consider every comment made and try to respond. You will not find that on any commercial radio station. They are accountable to advertisers. Different model results in different programming. You recognize that. You've chose to listen. So why not support it right now with your membership contribution?
Yeah, we do. And certainly, people understand we do get some government support. But I guess we'd also rather not be accountable to the people in Washington, D.C. or Springfield, for that matter. Certainly there, that kind of support, while it continues to be important and significant for us, I'm sure you've heard us talk about this year after year, that's eroded very steadily. So we can't rely on that. The most reliable source of financial support, that is the energy, the literal energy that it takes to drive the station, comes from listeners. And we actually like it that way. And people who contribute to the station have a real sense of ownership. That's real obvious when you talk to people and they tell you what they think about the programs that you broadcast. And, you know, that may be sometimes a little difficult for us because we can't please everybody, but we try real hard to listen to what people have to say, to act on good suggestions, to be responsive. We think that that's just part of the deal. That's not something that we can say, oh, we don't feel like it. No, that's part of what public broadcasting is all about. People support the service with their money, and we want them to participate and be listeners, sure, but we'd like them to be more than listeners. We'd like them to be active participants, and that's one of the things that really sets public broadcasting apart, I think, from other kinds of broadcasting.
It's not about the quantity. It's more about the quantity of support. Mm-hmm. Commercial station has ratings numbers. They live and die by their ratings numbers. We instead pay more attention to our supporters because our supporters give us a lot better information and keep us accountable to not just sheer numbers of listeners, but intelligent listeners, people who are seeking a different format on the radio dial. With your investment, we can continue doing it. We are thrifty and efficient. We have had to make some cuts over the last year. We don't want to make any more, and your continued support is what keeps your station strong.
All right. 244-9455. That's the number to call if you need to. Put on the area code 217, or if you'd like, you can go online and go to our pledge site. That's Will Pledge, just like it sounds, W-I-L-L Pledge, willpledge.org. In this hour focus, we're talking with Dan McCollum. He grew up here in Champaign County. He was the mayor of Champaign 3 terms. He's also been involved in local environmental movement here. He's been a political activist. He's been teacher. He was research assistant with the Illinois Natural History Survey, and he also, a lot of people know him, as a local historian. And he's authored a number of books, and I just want to, again, mention this one in particular. If you're interested in Champaign County and its history, you could look for his book, Remembering Champaign County. It's published by the History Press, and we're talking this morning about the history of Champaign County. And we have a caller here who's ready to go and get some other folks lined up. If you'd like to talk with Dan, maybe you have a particular question or you have some kind of story to contribute, that's great. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's somebody in Champaign to talk with, line number 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a place name question just over into Vermilion County. The strip mine spoils that were just east of Oakwood were often known as the polywogs. I know that a polywog is some kind of small reptile, but I wonder if you know how and when that name was first applied to this area of the strip mine spoils.
Well, that's a good question, and I've always been familiar with that term since my father was an avid fisherman, and I've put a plug in most of those various lakes and ponds over there, but I never thought about how it got its name. So you've baffled me. but I will look into it.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you. You've stumped the expert. That's pretty tough. Well, I appreciate the call.
Okay, thank you.
Other folks are welcome to call. Let's go over to Belgium, line number 4. That's in Vermilion County, but that's okay. Go ahead.
Yes. Yes, it is in Vermilion County. I missed a little bit of your program today, Mr. Inge, but I was wondering, it is true that actually, Champaign County was part of Vermilion County for many years because Vermilion County was settled much earlier because of the salt works and the rivers and stuff. But I always wondered, I also wanted to ask Mr. McCollum, are you the gentleman who wrote the book about the Vermilion watershed and the canoeing?
Yes, I am.
Yes.
I co-authored that with Jim Smith.
Ah, I've used that book many times. I've gone up and down the Vermilion Salt Fork and the Middle Fork many times. It's a beautiful canoeing area, which I find pretty interesting because yesterday Mr. Inge had a program on about coal, and the only wild and scenic river in Illinois, which is the Middle Fork River, which comes down through Vermilion County, was despoiled by a coal company. But you kind of wonder how can the wild and scenic have been torn up by a coal company. But that's just the facts. That's not about Champaign County, though. I was wondering, what is the history between Champaign and Vermilion County since they were essentially one at one time? Of course, you have to understand that Vermilion County went all the way from Chicago to Evansville at one time.
Well, actually, Edgar County did. When Vermilion County was created in 1826, and remember, it wasn't all that much earlier than Champaign County, which was 1833, but when Vermilion County was created, it was fenced off of Edgar County, and it included the actual county boundary was actually 10 miles into what is today Champaign County, which would put it somewhere around Mayview, and it was 6 miles shorter north-south. When John Vance drew the lines, he had to create a county that was of a viable size, so he took the 10 miles off the west portion of Vermilion County and gave it 6 miles into what was to become Iroquois County. These were territories that were actually administered by Vermilion County, but were not officially part of it until the final lines were drawn.
I see. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Back to another somebody here calling from Mahomet on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My husband and I live in Mahomet, and we live in the Scott Thomas House, which I'm not sure if I have the history correct. The house was built in 1872. It's a whole lot of fun to live here. But we heard that his father, Fielding, was responsible for plowing the way from Middletown, which was Mahomet then, to Champaign Urbana, to the courthouse or something. Do you have any information about that?
Yes, I do. Fielding was originally, when the county was established, they appointed regional road commissioners, people who handled various parts of the county, and as the county became more and more populated, the number of these road commissioners expanded, and that's well covered in the book that I talked about earlier, the essays on the historical geography. But one of the ways that when roads were delineated by the legislature was that they were through wooded areas, they were brazed. In other words, they made marks on trees to show that where they were supposed to run, and they plowed a furrow to delineate where they were across the prairie. When Cunningham wrote his book, he didn't quite explain that right, because Fielding actually was a road commissioner, and when the road was designated, and I think he might have had something to do with surveying, he may have been the surveyor, he actually plowed the furrow that became the old state road from Champaign to through Mahomet on to Bloomington. So he was just doing his job as other road commissioners did. When roads were designated across the open prairie, they just plowed a furrow to show folks where it was.
Well, that's interesting. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you. And other questions about Champaign County history, you're welcome to call in and talk with our guest, Dan McCollum, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think you said at the beginning of the program, one of the things that perhaps got you interested in learning more and researching more on local history was place names. And I said that a lot of place names are named after people. One of the things that I guess I didn't know is that St. Joe was named after a guy named Joe. It was named after a fellow named Joe Kelly, who had a tavern there, right?
Joe Kelly was John Vance's son-in-law,
mm-hmm.
and he moved out here with John Vance and worked originally at the Salt Works. He later then purchased the property on the Salt Fork, which is today about a mile, maybe south and a little west of the current village of St. Joe on the Salt Fork River, where a person named Cyrus Strong had built an inn. And that's where the road crossed the river. And a stranger came, according to the several accounts, that caught Joe Kelly's fancy, and the stranger, when he was ready to leave, was preparing to pay, and Kelly, who, according to the story, was so enchanted with the conversation of this gentleman, he refused to take any pay. And the gentleman said, "Well, I'll do something for you someday." And turns out it was about the time that a young lawyer who rode the circuit happened to be elected to Congress, served one term, was on the Postal Committee. I think it was Abraham Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
And so a warrant for the post office named St. Joseph came down, and Joe Kelly was named the postmaster.
A lot of folks in Mahomet listening this morning. I had another Mahomet caller. Well, let's talk with them on line number one. Hello.
Hi, are you calling me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I'm in Monticello, actually.
Oh, pardon. Well, pardon me.
That's all right.
Hello, Monticello.
Hi. I had a question for Mr. McCollum about, I was a co-author of a biography about Robert Allerton, and one of the things that I found in my studies were that his father, Samuel Allerton, when he started the town of Allerton, had planned to figure out how to annex a portion of Vermilion County and Champaign County and create a county called Allerton County, and that it fell through. And I was wondering if Mr. McCollum came across anything like that as well.
Well, Allerton actually is, the inhabited area of Allerton is in Vermilion County.
Okay.
But portion of it, which is in the corporate limits, as I understand it, is in Champaign County.
Right.
So I'm not sure what the senior Allerton had in mind, but it is interesting to note that the senior Allerton, Samuel Allerton, actually got a boost in his business enterprises, which was in the stockyards up in Chicago, by the willingness of B.F. Harris to let him take a drove of hogs up to up to Chicago on consignment.
Right, right.
And
that's when he cornered the market.
Yeah. Well, he did a pretty good job up there. Managed to do quite well, and then he followed B.F. Harris's advice in buying land down here. So the Allerton Holdings in the Monticello area and over in the eastern part of the county were largely due to the influence of B.F. Harris.
Right. I think that would be interesting to learn a lot about Mr. Harris.
He's an amazing guy.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
All right.
Appreciate
well,
it.
Thank you.
Bye.
And let's see. We'll come back here to Champaign for a caller, line number two. Hello.
Hi. I have a children's book that has come into my hands in pristine condition. It was published in 1961 here in Champaign by the Garrard Publishing Company. And it's Rain, Hail, Sleet, and Snow, Junior Science Book of. Does this have any historical significance? I tried to give it to the libraries, and they didn't want it because it's outdated. So I've been meaning to ask you, Daniel, anyway. So here you are, and I thought since it was locally published, somebody might have an interest in it. Would you know?
Well, probably the best place to take it, because if it has maybe some historical interest, as having been published in Champaign County, would be the Champaign County Archives at the Urbana Free Library.
Ah, okay.
And that's always a good place to start if for almost anything. I love to spend time over there.
Okay, so you think if anyone wants it, they would?
Well, they could, or certainly they might be able to give you a steer.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, very good. Thank you. Back next, we'll talk with someone in Bement. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I had a question about a little town called Ivesdale in Champaign County. I had family there, and occasionally there was legends that some of the gangsters, such as Al Capone, maybe even John Dillinger. So some of those guys would, when it got a little bit too hot for them up north, would scurry down this way. And Ivesdale was one of the places that was mentioned that they may have hung around. I wondered if Dan had any information on that. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Well, I don't know much about that. I know that the original name of Ivesdale was actually Norrie. But the land speculator that owned most of the land was named Ives. He who owns the land rules. So that's how Ivesdale got its name. But and the only other thing, of course, I know about Ivesdale that might not have the best connection is that it was one of the wet spots in Champaign County that was open after 1 o'clock. And I knew more than a few people whose cars could go down there on a late or early morning ride on almost automatic pilot.
Well, that's the best answer I guess we can give to that question. We have about 5-6 minutes left in this hour with Dan McComb. Questions are welcome. One of the things I wanted to have you talk a little bit about was a little bit about the history of the railroad, since that was very important to the development of the area. And also because of something that you write in the book is that some story that people keep passing around and can't let go of is that somehow the people who were in Urbana weren't smart enough to know the railroad was important and to get it to run through Urbana. That's not true at all. It sounds as if there were other forces at work that determined where the railroad ran, and it didn't really have anything to do with the people of Urbana not knowing that they needed to get it to be closer.
There's no good reason for the existence of that myth. Cunningham, who is the authority on virtually all early matters of Champaign County, says it's a myth. It was determined, the route of the railroad was determined purely by engineering and financial considerations. The incorporators of the Illinois Central Railroad were required to build a line from Chicago south to where it intersected the main Illinois Central line at Centralia. And at the time, in 1850, the census of Urbana, I think, was 256 people. It was a rude frontier hamlet. The railroad was not unmindful of Urbana, and at a point close to where the Fort Clark Road, or pardon me, the Old State Road crossed the tracks, the railroad established a station. They bought 80 acres and stuck a sign in along the tracks and said Urbana Station. So the myth is totally a myth.
And you also wonder why it is that when that happened, the people in Urbana just didn't pick up and move, that it moved the town. Such things have happened.
Oh, if Homer moved south to the tracks, and the original site of St. Joe was, again, about a mile, a little over a mile, southwest of the current village, and it moved to be on the tracks. Yeah, I think there was a lot of fiber over there in Urbana. Still there, I guess.
With those of us who live in Urbana, like to think so.
A lot of people did move. A lot of businesses did move because no longer did the mail come by stage from Indianapolis. It came south on the tracks.
Mm-hmm. Entire books have been written about the history of the University of Illinois and how it developed. That's something worthy of entire longer conversations. In fact, we've had some on the show. But you do have a section here about the Illinois Industrial University, as it was called. How did it happen that we ended up with this university in I suppose what some people would argue was a kind of a remote place?
Well, actually, it was on a main line down from Chicago, so it had good connections with obviously the largest population center of the state. And at the time, I don't think it was realized what a big deal. Well, I know it wasn't realized what a big deal this was going to become. There was some contention for the site, but I believe in the last analysis, two factors determined it. One was the exceptional lobbying effort led by Clark Robinson Griggs, who was a mayor of Urbana and also in the state legislature subsequently to engineer this whole deal, and the fact that it had good connections with Chicago.
We have another caller here. Want to get him in the time that remains, and that would be someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question about the name Champagne, spelled the way it is, A-I-G-N. I was told years ago that it comes from an English poem with a line in it called Champagne, Dale, and Hill, meaning undulating place, meadow, and hill.
Well, I think that I can...
Is that right?
Well, I think it came from most directly from Champaign County, Ohio.
Yes, I know. I heard you say that.
There's a region in France called
Do you know anything about an English poem that contains that same kind of word?
Well, but there's a region in France called Compagne, which is spelled very similar. And it's a gently rolling area in central eastern France. And I believe that probably is more likely the original derivation of the term.
Uh-huh. But you have no information about that poem.
I don't know the poem.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. So we're down here. We have a couple of minutes left. There's a lot of really interesting stuff in the book.
You haven't asked me what my favorite story was.
Oh, well, okay. Go with it. What's your favorite story?
My favorite story was, of course, the end of apartheid, which I was prompted to write that story originally by a lady who participated in the integration of Crystal Lake Pool in 1943, Daisy Jackson, Daisy Holt Jackson, who was a very amazing woman, and I tried to get her to write her story, and she wouldn't do it. She said, "You write it, Daniel." And when her daughter, who I didn't want to write, take her story, well, her daughter came back, retired from the Army, and I told her she needed to get that story written, and she said, "You write it, Daniel." So I finally had to write it. It's it's probably my favorite story in the book.
Well, we got a couple of minutes. You want to talk a little bit, and you can't maybe tell the story in full, but tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, apparently, one of the socially progressive groups in town at the, it's the offshoot of the Goose Pond Church. I think it's the Community United Church of Christ over on 6th Street. Realized that this was a very not something that ought to be present in Champaign or Champaign County, and led the effort to get a group of young black teenagers, girls, to try to force the issue. And in the last 2 weeks, I believe 1943, the Park Board, Urbana Park Board, relented, and they opened the pool to blacks only. In 1944, the pool was fully integrated. What I was never able to find because of the loss by fire of the Urbana Park records, Park District records, was the actual decisions made by the Park Board at the time. But it's, I guess, a little bit uncomfortable to think that in 1943, we were not only had a segregated public swimming pool, but the USOs for the soldiers was also segregated.
Yeah. That's just one story that you read in the book. There's a lot more here. So for folks who live here in and around Champaign-Urbana in Champaign County, I'm sure that you can learn some things about our home here, Champaign County, and you can look for the book here. It's titled Remembering Champaign County by our guest, Dan McCollum, and it's published by the History Press. They're based in Charleston, South Carolina. And if you'd like to find out more about the History Press, they do have a website, which is historypress.net. Otherwise, I expect that the book is available in local bookstores. Yes?
Yes, it is, and at the Champaign County Historical Museum.
All right. Hey, thanks very much, Dan.
Well, thank you.